And so the ancients viewed the stars as the tablets of the gods. And so when you see this constellation, do this. When you see this sign in the sky, I want you as my subject, as my worshiper, to do this act or to think of this. And so there were over 7,000 scenarios.
Ancient astrology.
Yes, ancient. This is the origin point of ancient astrology. There were 7,000 scenarios in Enuma Anu Enlil that when they saw something in the night sky, they knew their god wanted to communicate a certain message. And so what we see is when we use that original Babylonian teaching and we plug it in to cipher the astral prophecies of Revelation, it really unlocks it.
All things continually lead back to serpents, dragons, fairies, Nephilim, and fallen angels.
In the distance looms a mystical mountain.
As Mike Heiser used to say, if it's in the Bible and it's weird, it's probably important.
At its peak, a great fire burns, concealing the Prometheus lens.
This development of this knowledge that's being talked about within the mystery schools.
An ancient artifact said to reveal the hidden truth within a deliberately darkened world.
There is a hidden history that's been deliberately obfuscated from the peoples of the world.
Join us as we travel and explore the vast unknown. It's a hero's journey with dragons to slay, damsels to save, and innumerable treasures to hoard. Torches high.
The Smithsonian, they'd caught wind of a giant skeleton, would send their agents out to get it.
But it takes courage to move forward, to move out of the shadows, out of the unreality that we think of as reality.
We are all on the hero's journey.
Mankind has been in contact with and influenced by extraterrestrials.
Leave the Sitchin mound of bull feathers out of it.
You know, look at it from a different perspective.
What is happening and what is up? Hold out your glass, because we're about to fill it up. Welcome to the Prometheus Lens Podcast, the place where the conversations are always enlightening. I'm your host, Justin, and here we like to use the allegory of the Prometheus Lens to take a second look at everything. Well, today is just a God thing. That's what I like to call it. It's just, was scrolling through Facebook, and my good old buddy Kenny C, he's always posting good books, and I usually, feed off of him and grab some of the titles that he likes and recommends. And he come through and he recommended this book. And in big, bold letters, it talked about the four horsemen of the apocalypse and how they're tied to the Babylonian gods. And I was like, ooh, now that really sparks my interest. So then I noticed that he had tagged the person that he was friends with him. So then I click and I go into detective mode and find this guy and reach out to him, and I'm like, hey man, I would love to have you on my show and talk about this book. And he immediately messaged me back and was like, well, hey, what are you doing tonight? I'm like, well, let's do this thing. I was excited. So got a real good treat for you guys today. I'd like to welcome to the show Tyler Gilreath. Tyler, thank you for coming on, man.
Justin, I appreciate you having me. It's great to connect with you, man. You mentioned Kenny C earlier, and me and Kenny's been friends for a couple of years, and so you always can rely on Kenny for a lot of different things, and it's cool that him sharing that post got us connected tonight, a God thing, like you said. And I'm looking forward to talking all things supernatural and getting into some deep stuff in Revelation and elsewhere. So thanks for having me on, Justin.
No, I think this is going to be a hand-in-glove situation. I think we're going to get along just fine. But just for the people that's unfamiliar with you, just go ahead and introduce yourself, your background, just give everybody a feel of who you are and some of the books that you have written, because this is not your first book, correct?
Correct, yeah. So again, my name is Tyler. I've written two books now. The first one you see behind me, Gospel Over Gods. That book came out about 3 years ago, and it chronologically tracks the supernatural war of the Bible. So the three divine rebellions, which is Eden, you know, in the days of Noah, and then the Tower of Babel. And so that has a narrative feel. It utilizes over 2,000 scriptures in that book. And it also has a topical feel as well. So it's a great book for someone that's never been introduced to the supernatural struggle of the Bible from an ancient perspective. And it was written to be a book of evidence. I have a ton of quotes from church fathers, historians, Dead Sea Scroll material. It's really kind of an all-in-one resource. And so it's a great book for people to start with and get the story. But when that book was done, I honestly thought I'd probably never write another book again. But then I started getting into the book of Revelation. And I talked about Revelation just a little bit in the first book, but I wanted to see those divine rebellions play out in the book of Revelation. And so that is where this latest book, which you alluded to earlier, comes in, and that is Revelation, the Messiah and the Second Coming of Babylon. Of course, the title is Gate of the Gods. And this book will really transform and unlock the way people see the book of Revelation. And I'm sure, I don't know if you have specific questions to get started, but I think in most churches, most people, they've been told, hey, everything in Revelation is about Rome. Okay. Nothing too exciting, at least for us. Right. And nothing to see here. Move on. And I'm not denying, you know, in the book that Rome's not a factor. I think everyone knows Rome was kind of a modern day Babylon because of the way Nebuchadnezzar pretty much, you know, destroyed Jerusalem and you know, carried them away into captivity, things like that. So, you know, we're not disputing that. But what we are saying is that essentially Babylon the Great also has a dual element, a cosmic element, not a temporal one, which was Rome, but a cosmic element that dates back to really the Tower of Babel. And so Babylon the Great is this great chaotic force, machine of evil and chaos that runs the nations amok. And God is very much interested in bringing the Babel rebellion to an end. And so this book explores Babylon the Great from the cosmic perspective. And it really does two things. The first thing it does, the book does, it establishes that the Old Testament is kind of the template for the book of Revelation. I go to that in great detail. Essentially, Revelation is blender theology. It is you take little snippets and verses and phrases from the Old Testament Hebrew prophets, and you throw them into a blender, and you hit the start button, and what comes out oftentimes are what we see in Revelation. And so if we understand that and we kind of know the template and the blueprints, then it can really unlock a lot of the meaning and make things make sense. So beyond the template, though, again, there's this mysterious Babylon the Great, which I said in a large part, you know, goes back to Babel. Babylon is inseparable from the Babel event. And I demonstrate that in the book. But what this book does that I'm not aware of any other book out there on the subject does is it looks for Babylonian elements, Babylonian traces in the book of Revelation. For example, this book, I get into Babylonian creation stories, Babylonian monsters, beasts, right, that are in Revelation. Babylonian astrology is a big part, especially when you get to the astral prophecy sections of Revelation. And so what John does and Jesus does through the book of Revelation is we're going to tear down Babylon on all fronts. Okay, we're literally going to tear down chaos, but we're also literarily going to tear down chaos. And so Revelation taps into the, you know, ancient archives of Babylonian material to demonstrate superiority and a, you know, really deconstruction of Babylon at the very core of what they stand for and what they believe and what they've taught. And so, if that interests somebody out there to look for Babylonian threads in the book of Revelation, then this book is, you know, right up your alley.
Now, are you referring to the Enuma Elish when you were talking about that? Because that's something that's been fascinating to me, and my listeners are pretty familiar with. I did a 3-part series with Dr. Judd Burton on the Enuma Elish, and we talked about some of the correlations that we had seen. And like how you said, it's the whole on earth as it is in heaven. You know, when there's a something happening, a war, whatever on earth, you know, there's a mirrored image, same thing going on in, you know, in heaven or in the spiritual realm also.
Right.
And that's a biblical theme.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
And so when we got to looking at that, we were talking about how Tiamat, the chaos dragon, was subdued by
Marduk.
Marduk, yes, thank you. And so in our creation story, they were literally, you know, like a literary, as you put it, showing that Yahweh was superior.
Exactly.
So he subdued chaos when he hovered over, you know, the waters, the Tahom, you know, because that was wordplay that was the same name.
Yeah.
And then you see this beast again in Revelation. So, I mean, this is something from start to finish that's in the text.
You're right. Yeah. And, you know, I'm glad you brought that up. You know, Genesis 1:2, you know, the Spirit of God is arresting chaos, arresting the waters of chaos. You know, and you mentioned Enuma Elish, and essentially there were 7 tablets found, I believe, in the 1800s. By kind of a modern day Indiana Jones fella. And if I'm not mistaken, they were in the Library of Ashurbanipal. And what those 7 tablets entailed was, again, their creation story. And many people would I think a lot of Christians would get a little sweaty and nervous when you say, you know, Genesis is kind of tapping into some of that material. And, but what I say is there's no reason to be nervous about it. You know, again, God is looking to, be superior on every front. And so when Moses wrote the Pentateuch, you know, wrote Genesis and the other books, first 5 books of the Bible, there were other creation stories, you know, already out there. You know, a couple thousand years older than, you know, when Moses was writing. And so why wouldn't you want to sink the other stories? Why wouldn't you want to thwart the other stories? Why would you not want to knock off the other stories? And another thing to think about, too, is in Job 38, the sons of God were there present at creation. And so the spirits of Babylon and who are behind these other narratives, creation stories, they witnessed what really happened as well. And so it's possible they took elements of the historical, how things went down and put it in their stories. So, but you're right. Yeah. Genesis 1:2 to home, is kind of that, Hebrew word there. And, you see the Spirit of God arresting it. Arresting chaos. And in the Enuma Elish, Marduk defeats Tiamat and ascends to King of the Gods at Babylon shortly thereafter. And so Revelation is tapping into that same story. Genesis and Revelation are bookends. And so it makes sense that when you get to the book of Revelation, when he's describing in the new heavens and new earth that the sea will be no more, there's a reason why. There's a reason why the sea will be no more.
He's not talking about no more Atlantic Ocean, is he?
No, exactly. The sea is a cosmic symbol of chaos, which ultimately represents the chaos Elohim in the spirit realm. And so one of the things I talk about in the book is that sea that will be no more. There was a sea. Though I think most people know that in the temple, the tabernacle, you had different lavers or bowls of water, essentially, for washing and ceremonial purposes. And there was a sea, just like one of the seas in the tabernacle in the temple of Marduk. And it was a twin of the one that we read about that the Hebrews had. And that sea in the temple of Marduk represented his defeat of Tiamat.
What is happening? What is up? Hold out your glass, because we're about to fill it up with some Kevlar Joe's coffee, of course. I want to encourage you guys to head on over to KevlarJoe's.com for your caffeine fix. If you enjoy the show, help us keep the lights on by supporting the sponsor of this show. Head on over to KevlarJoe.com right now. And now that you got your brew ready, sit back, relax, and enjoy the journey, guys.
The chaos dragon. And so even going back to the Old Testament, we see that, you know, not only is God literally going to defeat and win the day, but he's going to put the same symbolism in his tabernacle, in his temple, to show that, no, he's superior over chaos, not Marduk. And so this whole book, Marduk keeps popping up over and over and over again, because Marduk is king of the gods of Babylon. And so literally it's Yahweh versus Marduk almost all the way through the book of Revelation. By the way, he is one of the demonic riders that I talk about in great detail. But I'm glad you brought that up, because that is so important, how God will defeat chaos or did defeat chaos in Genesis, and he's going to do it again in the book of Revelation. And so the Enuma Elish is one of the historical documents that I refer to in there as well, in the book, but there's others. Another one is Marduk Ea. One thing I talk about in this book is how the book of Enoch actually parrots stylistically certain sections of the Marduk Ea document. Another document that I talk about in here is called the Enuma Anu Enlil. And of course, Enuma is kind of in the beginning, and Anu is one of the gods, and Enlil is one of the gods. And so that's kind of the first three words. And so
that was basically the god of heaven and the god of the abyss, right?
Yes, essentially. Yeah, essentially. And what, you know, Babylon, and the stories of Babylon, they're not always linear. In other words, they're somewhat evolved over time as far as who is superior and who reigned king of the gods. And so there's kind of this transformation. But the document Enuma Anu Enlil was 70 tablets, okay, that essentially was a map and a cipher for reading the stars. And so the ancients viewed the stars as the tablets of the gods. And so when you see this constellation, do this. When you see this sign in the sky, I want you as my subject, as my worshiper, to do this act or to think of this. And so there were over 7,000 scenarios.
Ancient astrology.
Yes, ancient. This is the origin point of ancient astrology. There were 7,000 scenarios in Enuma Anu Enlil that when they saw something in the night sky, they knew their God wanted to communicate a certain message. And so what we see is when we use that original Babylonian teaching and we plug it in to cipher the astral prophecies of Revelation, it really unlocks it because those messages line up, and I know we'll talk about that in just a little bit. But yeah, those are some of the, you know, Babylonian documents and Babylonian records that come into play in the Book of Revelation. And by the way, some people may push back against this and say, how are John's readers, you know, supposed to know this Babylonian material? Well, Babylonian astrology and the stories of Babylon survived, and not only survived, they thrived well into the 4th century.
Yeah, and their people was held captive there, you know, all that time.
Exactly.
Their traditions and religion, even, I mean, I know it sounds bad, but it did. It kind of acclimated.
Exactly. It acclimated it. And that is why, depending on, you know, the Book of Enoch is very controversial. Not really controversial for me and you, but it is somewhat controversial for, I guess, when it was written, right? Did Enoch write the Book of Enoch, or did someone else? And so one of the things I've discovered, and it doesn't really matter where you know what you believe on that, because we still have the book, and it's important, and it's utilized. That's the point.
And Jesus and his apostles quoted it. So in the very least, it was oral tradition that was recorded later in a worst case scenario for a timeline. Worst case scenario.
And one of the things I'm seeing, though, and I may write another book about this. I want to dedicate a whole book to kind of what I'm going to get into. But there seems to be an agenda, at least a memory of the Babylonian stories in the Book of Enoch. I mentioned a minute ago the style in which it was written, as far as, and that's in the book. I don't know if I have the page number. Maybe I can locate it in a minute, but I have a whole chart of how the Book of Enoch is mirroring the Marduk Ea incantation. You see it right here. So it kind of starts there and goes on to the next page. I don't know if you can see that or not, but essentially there is a pattern kind of going on.
And another aspect too is, like, I know a lot of people, you know, like you said, they get hung up on it, and it's like, you know, God wants to show that he is superior, you know, in every way. But at the same time, like you said, these fallen angelic beings were there and witnessed the real thing. So they are imitating it and perverting it. But at the same time, you got to look at it from, you know, the perspective of the heathen or the pagan. God loves all. He wants to save all. So why wouldn't he take something that a pagan or a heathen that's a non-believer, take something that they are real familiar with and they know, and use that as a way, as a conduit back to him? You know, why would he not do that?
Exactly. Yeah. And so, it makes perfect sense. You know, we're not saying everything written in pagan material is accurate. We're just saying we're saying some of it is, and a lot of it's probably inspired by dark forces. But that's not the point. You know, the point is God taps into this really archive of material, and he wants to take the fight. He wants to make sure that he wins the literary fight as much as he wins the literal fight. And because you know, now we have the internet, we have all different means of communication, but the written word was it. That was the authoritative force for thousands of years. And so, again, not to beat a dead horse, but when Moses is writing the Pentateuch, or not even just Moses, we see that the psalmist quotes from the bell cycle. And they want to not only relate to their audience or future potential audience, but they want to be superior in the genre of literature. And that's exactly what we see. I've read so much, and I know you have as well, Justin, I've read so much ancient material. Nothing compares to the Bible. I mean, it just doesn't. It doesn't flow the same. It's not as deep. It doesn't have those layers like an onion that we find the Bible have. It's just, it's very material outside the biblical literature is very choppy. It's very fragmentary. It's just very dry. It's not the same. I mean, the Bible is superior on so many levels.
And just the end game, you know, like when you look, you know, one offers you a paradise, one offers you 70 virgins, and all these, the God requires that you sacrifice blood and all these things to them. Well, this is the only religion that your God bleeds for you. And it's all about family, you know, take your virgins. You can have your virgins. You can have your gold and all this stuff. You know, I want to go back into the family of God. You know, that we have a divine elder race of brothers and sisters. You know, the Bible overall theme is the parable of the prodigal son. We were the ones that went away and had to have our inheritance now and squandered it away, while our elder brothers, the angelic race, was there in the beginning, never left, and some of them got upset with us and rebelled. But, you know, our Father's waiting by the fence with open arms ready to take us back. And one day we're going to get to sit in our Father's house with our elder brothers and sisters, angelic race, and share, you know, bread and meals and have all the secrets, you know, revealed unto us.
Yeah.
And be in communion with our Creator. No other religion offers that.
No, they really don't. And that's the beauty of, you know, the gospel, the beauty of Jesus, and the message and the hope that, that we have in Christ, that again, these ancient religions, they're just so on a different level, not in a good way. They're so lesser, on every front. So, I couldn't agree more.
Now you got me curious, because you know, the whole astral prophecy and the signs in the heavens and things like that has really been a fascination of mine the past few years. And I didn't know about the whole the Enuma Enlil and Ea tablets. So now I'm going to have to look into that, because even the number, you know, 70, you know, that's a symbolic number for all. So then that ties right back to the Tower of Babel and the 70 nations and the sons of God. So you definitely got me wanting to check that stuff out. I'd love to take a deeper dive into that and the astral side of Revelation.
Yeah. It's again, the Enuma Anu Enlil was a set of 70 tablets that was the standard for processing what the gods want us to know. And so, you know, when we, you know, use that in the book of Revelation, it really unlocks the meaning behind everything. And so it's, again, a lot of modern Christians don't even know about, you know, there was such a standardization of reading the stars, which goes back again to the Watchers. You know, the Book of Enoch demonstrates that with a lot of clarity, you know, that part of the sin of the Watchers is, sure, you know, the marrying women and producing Nephilim, and that was a big part of why the world got so wicked so fast. But a lot of the other part was they brought a lot of this divine forbidden knowledge into the world. And so, you know, part of that was the reading of the stars. And so the Book of Enoch actually names, you know, the different watchers and the divine knowledge that they brought into the world. And so it goes back to that prehistory, where man was introduced to this concept, and evidently it survived the flood, or he was reintroduced, because we see what we see at Babel is, again, the nations being dispersed, being assigned an angelic viceroy, a tutelary spirit, an angel shepherd, if you will, a guide to watch over them. And Babel, that is the event that drove the rest of the Old Testament from Genesis 10 and 11 going forward. And that knowledge of reading the stars was prevalent even from that point going forward as well. And so whether it survived the flood or whether they reintroduced the knowledge, you know, we're not exactly sure on that. But that standardization goes back to Babylon the Great. And so, surprise, surprise, you know, this whole book's about, you know, Babylon the Great versus Yahweh or the Messiah, Jesus. And so when we use that book of standardization or those tablets and we plug in what we find in our Bibles, it really unlocks. So we can talk about.
Well, I'm curious because, I mean, I didn't know anything about this. So this is all new to me, and which I love it. Like, could you give like one or two examples of something that plays out in Revelation that ties into this? And
okay. So we could talk about, let's just talk about the four horsemen just for a minute. So essentially, and I can read this. I mean, you know, I don't know. Let me just read Revelation 6, 1 through 8, and then we'll go back and talk about it. Again, this is the text of the, you know, the four horsemen. I saw that the Lamb opened one of the seven seals, and I heard one of the four living creatures saying, as with a voice of thunder, come and see. Then a white horse appeared, and he who sat on it had a bow. A crown was given to him, and he came out conquering and to conquer. When he opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature say, come. Another came out with a red horse. To him who sat on it was given power to take peace on the earth, and that they should kill one another. There was given to him a great sword. When he opened the third seal, I heard the third living creature say, come and see. Behold, a black horse, and he who sat on it had a balance in his hand. And I heard a voice in the middle of the four living creatures saying, a kinnix of wheat for denarii, and three kinnix of barley for denarii or denarius. Don't damage the oil and the wine. When he opened the fourth seal, I heard the fourth living creature say, come and see. Behold, a pale horse, and the name of he who sat on it was Death. Hades followed with him, authority over one-fourth of the earth to kill with the sword, with famine, with death, and by the wild animals of the earth was given to him. So that's the, you know, the text there, Revelation 6, 1 through 8. And so when we use the Enuma Anu Enlil, what we see is, well, there's a pattern. For example, in the Enuma Anu Enlil, it associates certain gods with certain colors, planets, constellations, and directions. Okay, that's kind of the pattern there. I'll go ahead and show that to you so you can see that. Certain colors, certain directions, certain planets, certain constellations. And so the colors of Revelation's horses and the action taken by the riders do in fact correlate to four corresponding planets, four demonic Babylonian gods, four cardinal directions, and four constellations per the manual. And so the color white is associated with Jupiter, which is associated with Marduk, which is associated with Taurus, which is associated with the East. Red is associated with Mercury, the planet Mercury, which is associated with Nabu, which is the deity Nabu, which is associated with Aquarius, the constellation, which is associated with the North. All right, then the next one, black, is associated with Saturn, which is associated with Inerta, which is relates to Scorpio, the constellation, and the direction of west.
Yeah, and death, you know, death, where is thy sting? The scorpion.
Yeah. Pale, the pale or speckled, depending on your translation, is associated with Mars, which gets associated with Nurgle, which gets associated with Leo, the constellation, and the direction of south.
Hey guys, got a call to action for you. If you're enjoying the show, please take the time to share this episode with family and friends on social media. Hey, speaking of social media, find us on our various platforms. The banner down below can show you where to find those. If you want to support the show, but don't want the monthly subscription to the members-only community or the All Access Pass, you can also do a one-time donation to help support the show. Find us on PayPal or Venmo, username ElRod32, ElRod32. All donations will get a shout out and a thank you on a recording. Thank you guys for all the love and support. Back to the episode.
Basically, the clearest example, we'll just start with this, is black Scorpio. Okay. I looked, and behold, there was a black horse, and he who sat on it had a pair of scales in his hand. Since the two claws of Scorpio were seen also as the balances of Libra, the connection is obvious. Okay, so when you're, you know, you see a scorpion, he had balances in his hand. And again, it's associated with color black. So the rider on the black horse would be Ninurta, and he's coming from the west. Let's look at another one. So let's talk about the direction south just for a minute. So south, and again, I'm just kind of referencing the book here. It's on page 107 if people pick up a copy. But south is connected with Leo, the constellation Leo, and the deity is Nurgle, who is the king of the netherworld, connected with wild animals, death, and pestilence. So there is a pale horse. Okay, this is him. And the name of him who sat on it was Death, and Hades followed him. And he, of course, had power over a fourth of the earth that was given to him to kill with the sword, with hunger, with death, and by beast of the earth. And so you see this netherworld deity who gets associated with this particular color coming from this direction, who's described as, you know, death, associated with death. The next one would be the rider on the red horse. So, and he's coming from the north direction. Okay. So north in Aquarius, the constellation Aquarius, is linked to Nabu, the main war god at the time. And thus a sword was given to him. Okay, so that makes sense. If you look up Aquarius, you know, Aquarius is a picture of a man, the constellation with a sword. So he's the war god. Okay. And then the most mysterious one, the most important one, the rider on the white horse. Who would that be? Well, that would be Marduk. Marduk is associated with white, Jupiter, Taurus, and the East, per the divination manual that I mentioned earlier, Enuma Anu Enlil.
Yeah, and even the Enuma Elish, you know, he was the one with the bow,
There you
go. He was the conqueror of Tiamat and crowned the king through his creation. Bingo. Yeah.
Bingo. So I'll read the section here. You hit it in the nail on the head. Marduk's ascension to kingship status in the Babylonian pantheon can explain what John saw. I looked and behold a white horse, and the one who seated on it had a bow, and a crown was given him. Marduk was crowned king of the gods by defeating Tiamat, the chaotic deity of the sea, with an arrow that split her in two halves. This victory solidified Marduk as head of the pantheon and ousted On from heaven's throne. And so the picture would then paint Marduk, king of the gods of Babylon, riding from the east as a demonic equestrian set on conquering. And we know that Marduk is named in the Bible in Jeremiah 50 and Jeremiah 51. One passage calls him Marduk, and one calls him Bel, not Baal, B-A-A-L, but B-E-L. And so let me read a little bit more here. In the Babylonian exorcistic incantation Mardukia, the god Marduk is framed as a liberator of the possessed, a savior to the downtrodden. Truly, this is dark deception at its finest. Marduk, the rider on the white horse, is not benevolent or a savior. He's malevolent. And so what a lot of people have done when they read this, they think, okay, you got three demonic figures and then one good figure. No, he's not a good figure.
Yeah, I've always been told that the rider on the white horse is Christ, but it's the same time, it's, you know, it's an antichrist.
Exactly. He's an antichrist figure. He's Marduk was kind of positioned as, again, a savior figure. And so it's amazing because you also have in Revelation, you have Christ on a white horse, the Messiah. And so you have, again, the Messiah versus Marduk. Okay. All the way through the book of Revelation. And this is perhaps the clearest example. Again, it really opens up the text once the light bulb goes off. Oh, okay. These colors.
And it hinges back to Genesis 3:15. I just had a premonition too, or a thought, you know, everything hinges on Genesis 3:15, the seed war,
right?
You know, that's Christ and the Antichrist, both of them riding in on white horses to do battle. And ultimately one's going to get his head crushed.
Exactly.
But we know who that is.
Yeah. Yeah. We know who that is. We know who wins the day. And so, you know, it's amazing, man. I mean, I don't know why. I said this earlier. I don't know. I guess I don't know why we haven't looked for Babylonian connections in Babylon the Great in the book of Revelation. It seems too obvious. But I guess, you know, traditionally church history in modern day, at least, you know, we've been so focused on Rome that we've not looked for the cosmic Babylon. And, you know, it makes sense that, you know, John is going to tap into Babylon's material to talk about Babylon the Great, you know, and to defeat Babylon the Great. And again, a lot of this, I mentioned the book of Enoch earlier. One of the things I talk about in here again is I think part of the book of Enoch is vying for the narrative with Babylon. And one theory I have is just a theory that First Enoch in particular, chapters 1-36 was written by potentially a Jew who was carried away into Babylon. It would be around that time period that a lot of scholars think it was written, perhaps. But it would make sense, you know, if that was the case, that who one individual or several individuals, whoever penned First Enoch, had an agenda, and they used Babylonian terminology. Even the watchers is a Babylonian term. That's why we find the term the watchers in the book of Daniel, the only place that's in the Bible. And Daniel, of course, is in Babylon. So it would make a lot of sense. And, you know, one of the things I also talk about in the book is First Enoch connections in the book of Revelation. And there are several in the book of Revelation that don't really get a lot of attention. But again, if we're trying to take down Babylon, you know, why not use Enochian bullets to put in your barrel and shoot in their direction? Because ultimately, you know, it all goes back to, again, their demonic Elohim, which largely go back to the Tower of Babel event.
And I like your theory. I mean, it's a sound theory. I'd never really thought of that, because if, you know, if a Jewish man or woman is in captivity in Babylon, and if they are in the courts of the Magi, like Daniel was, Right. They're teaching you, exactly, you know, the signs of the heavens. They're teaching you the paths of the stars and the planets, and how to, you know, Read the solstices and the equinoxes and the precession and all these things. And of course they know that, you know, these things that they're saying are true, but they're perverted and told from a fallen realm perspective. So they have the inside gist.
Yeah.
And writing it down and exposing it, because in Enoch, it talks about the storehouses of heaven and the windows of heaven and all these, you know, esoteric things that was taught by the Magi.
Exactly. That's exactly right. You know, another thing that I talk about in the book that relates to Revelation and the book of Enoch and, you know, Babylonian literature is Revelation 9:1-4, where it talks about when the abyss is opened and the, you know, these scorpions, or not the scorpions, the smoke obviously comes out of the abyss, and demonic locusts come up from the earth that are released. And one of the things I mentioned is that those are the watchers that will be released at the end of time. And from a Babylonian perspective, there's no conflict either, because from the Babylonian narratives, they are called the Akkalu. And so I, you know, get into that and really, again, how the Jewish book of First Enoch kind of reorients the Babylonian Akkalu narrative, and kind of revisit that. But
and a lot of the Babylonian stuff too have their guardian gods, you know, like their gate guardians and stuff like that, as half scorpion men.
Exactly.
So there's another connection.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And there was a book, I was trying to see what the reference was. It kind of gets into that. I quoted maybe I'll find it in a minute. But
well, the Epic of Gilgamesh talks about it as he's going through the seven mountains on his way. To battle the great beast of the cedar forests, and he has to be let through the mountain pass by these scorpion guardians, scorpion men.
Right. Yeah. So it makes sense, you know, why you get that terminology, you know, coming through in Revelation. But again, if you're not familiar with the Akkalu narrative, the seven pre-flood gods, and, you know, you're probably going to miss a whole lot. Another thing that I'll mention is another astral prophecy. You know, Dr. Heiser, the late Dr. Heiser, did quite a bit of work talking about September 11th, 3 BC. Are you familiar with that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. We've done shows on it, talking about it. And yeah. Some of these and other guys that wrote books on it. Revelation 12.
Yeah, right. So one of the things that I talk about in this book is that particular scripture. But I look at it from a Babylonian perspective. In other words, what would be going on during Babylon during that time as well. And so, yeah, here it is. It's on page 119. It's entitled Tishri, Marduk, and the Gods of Babylon. And so, again, Dr. Heiser and others have pointed out kind of the Jewish perspective, you know, primarily. But I ask, okay, again, let's not forget Babylon the Great in this whole context. What was going on in Babylon during that time? And so before I answer that, one of the things I do is I kind of lay out how the Babylonian calendar was really the blueprints for the Jewish calendar as we know it. In other words, some of the months are almost verbatim the same, you know, spelled the same, look the same, sound the same kind of thing. So the modern Jewish calendar or the ancient Jewish calendar is based on the Babylonian calendar. But let me bring something out here that I think would be kind of eye-opening to folks. So in the month Tishri, right, which is September in our calendar, Revelation 12 has Mary birthing the Messiah. Well, the Babylonians worshipped Shamash. The month of Tashritu was dedicated to this deity. Shamash fits the messianic profile to a T. He was deemed the judge, the king, the shepherd. He is said to give light to the world, loosen the bonds of the imprisoned, grant health to the sick, and even revive the dead. Does that sound familiar? Obviously, Jesus is that. And so Jesus being born in Tishri, or Tashratu, in some ways dethrones the claims of Shamash. But that's one of the things. But here's perhaps the most damning of all. Babylon celebrated its New Year festival during Tishri. Okay, it was called the Akitu festival. It was officially celebrated for 11 consecutive days in the month. The Akitu festival was a time for the gods to decree fates and for the reign of earthly kings to be renewed or struck down. It was also a momentous festival for, catch this, Marduk. Marduk, of course, was the rider on the white horse. Ancient texts reveal that for the Akitu festival in Babylon, Marduk left his temple and convened in the holy Akitu chapel outside the city's walls with his bands of lesser gods. And on the fourth day of the festival, the priest recited the Enuma Elish, which describes Marduk's victory over the chaos monster Tiamat. On day five, the cultic priests reenacted the Enuma Elish to reinforce the victory of their lord. While the festival was completed, or when the festival was completed, Marduk went back to his temple, where he was re-enthroned as patron deity. His renewed subjects then sang a celebratory hymn to acknowledge him as king of the gods at Babylon. And so that was all going on historically in the very month that Jesus was born. Okay? Now, God doesn't forget anything. Okay? Neither do the powers of darkness, quite frankly. And so, dates matter. Months matter. Especially in this cosmic war. And so, to see that astral prophecy in the book of Revelation, a book which is jabbing at Babylon the Great, I just think it may be a minor thing. It may be a secondary line, but it's there. And understanding what goes on in the month of Tishri in Babylon the Great is just, you know, another example of how Christ stole the show. And he was more important than Marduk. Right. September 11th, 3.
And it brings a whole new perspective, too, that the Magi that came from Babylon
exactly
during this month
exactly
to lay gifts at at Jesus' feet. And it brings a whole new meaning and perspective to Lord of Lords and King of Kings.
Exactly. And that's one of the things I tried to bring out was, you know, the fact that they left their priestly responsibilities, because that's what Magi were. They were, you know, priestly figures. They left their priestly duties, which was a very busy month in Tishri, you know, Babylon, to come and lay their gifts at Jesus' feet, you know, is just, again, another win for Jesus and another defeat for them. One more connection I'll add on this layer of this onion. I said it was a very busy month in Babylon. So another, if we can fit more into the schedule, another key element to this is the Anunnaki, which is a group of evil demons who are wandering spirits on the earth. Essentially, on the festival of Marduk, sacrifices were also offered to the Anunnaki as well. Nebuchadnezzar II dedicated an altar at the walls of Babylon to the Anunnaki, which he called an altar of joy and an altar of rejoicing. And so what we see, you know, in this astral prophecy, from Babylonian holidays to the epics to the omens of early Mesopotamia, Jesus' birth in Tishri would have sent shockwaves across the cosmic landscape and really irritated the powers of darkness. So that's one of the things I talk about.
Man, that's just awesome, Tyler. I really appreciate you coming on and talking. I don't want you to give away the whole book. I could sit here and talk to you for another hour and dig through all this stuff, but I want to dig through and find it myself, and I want the listeners to get this book and find it out for themselves. But you've definitely sparked my interest, and I know you have some others.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's always more to find, always more to dig, and you know, just appreciate you bringing me on the show, and you know, hopefully if they like what they heard, they'll pick up a copy. It's on Amazon. So and you know, you can of course buy the first book as well. If you haven't dove into that material, that would be an added bonus. And so kind of the two together, you get Genesis through Revelation very thoroughly, looking at the, you know, the cosmic powers of evil. So,
well, I want to bring you back, and I think we should, I think that tees us up for a good conversation on the three rebellions.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I would love to get into it. I could talk for hours.
Oh, yeah, same. Well, guys, be sure to check out Tyler's book. Find it on Amazon, as he said. Do you have a website or anything like that, YouTube channel, Tyler? Or?
I used to have one. It's currently not up right now, so okay. I would just point people to Amazon and check that out. I will be having some promotional videos that will be coming out in the next couple months on Skywatch TV.
Okay.
So maybe be looking for some of that content and just kind of another interview. And I'll be on some other podcasts coming up as well.
Nice.
So as we kind of get this book kicked off and try to get as much exposure as possible. So,
right. Well, did the Prometheus Lens get the first interview?
You got the first.
You heard it here first, folks. We were here first.
You were here first. You beat everybody to the punch.
That's funny. Well, Tyler, thank you again, man. I really enjoyed the conversation. I appreciate your time. And especially since I found out you're so close to me. You're less than 2 hours away, brother. We got to hang out.
We got to get together, man.
Yeah. Well, guys, thank you for tuning in. Be sure to check out the books. And as always, until next time, torches high, guys.